The prayer to lighten our darkness is centuries old. And I think it raises the question for us, what is darkness and what is light? I think we could raise that question for different categories of people, for children. I remember as a child that I was terrified of the dark on that second floor bedroom. And not only did I need the light in the hall, but I needed my mother to stay with me until I fell asleep. And she was generous enough to do that. I was very fearful of the dark. We can talk about third world darkness. Darkness that we perceive in the third world, or among us, U.S.ers. We're going to talk about those darknesses that we perceive in the third world and that we perceive among us in the U.S. And I think every one of us personally could identify darknesses in our own lives of depression and death and loneliness and isolation. We could name hundreds of darknesses in our lives. In talking about the third world and my particular experience with India, I remember well how we as missionaries out of the U.S. were really preconditioned about the darkness of the heathen. Do you remember that? And do you remember hymns that raised up that particular characteristic of third world peoples, of the heathen? I think that began to change even 40 years ago. It began to change. But I don't think that metamorphosis is complete. Remember from Greenland's icy mountains? Can we, whose souls are lighted with wisdom from on high, can we to men benighted the lamp of life deny? Salvation, O salvation, the joyful sound proclaim, till each remotest nation has learned Messiah's name, the benighted heathen. Verse 2 of Rise Thou, Light of Gentle Nations. See the blindness of the heathen, strangers to thy glorious light, straying hopeless till they find thee, wandering aimless in the night. See their pitiful condition. Lo, gross darkness covers all, and no ray of hope refreshes nor dispels the dreadful fall. Look from the Sphere of Endless Day. It's another hymn. This is the old blue hymnal that we used in the Missouri Synod. And those hymns, I don't believe, are incorporated in the new LBW, but they still do exist in the, as far as I know, in their hymnal. And I'm not taking cracks at them. I'm just saying it's a way of looking at theology and of witnessing. Look from thy sphere of endless day, O God of mercy and of might. In pity look on those who stray, benighted in this land of light. Talking about our own people who are in darkness. And one, two more. O'er the gloomy hills of darkness, cheered by no celestial ray, Son of righteousness arising, bring the bright, the glorious day. Let the morning of thy blessed gospel dawn. All indicators of darkness. O Christ, our true and only light. And that's a very familiar one. O Christ, our true and only light, enlighten those who sit in night. Let those afar now hear thy voice, and in thy fold with us rejoice. Fill with the radiance of thy grace the souls now lost in error's maze, and all whom in their secret minds Some dark delusion haunts and blinds. Very dark shaping of our minds over against the heathen without Christ. I thought that was kind of important to share with you because it colored my entrance into India and how I perceived of the Indian people. Even though we were going through a period of change of really looking at the world as an interdependent world, it colored the way we approached the Indian people. And I really have to confess to a sense of zeal that I had when I entered India in the early missionary days that really targeted the Indian people as targets of my God's conversion. And I think I assumed, you know, there's so much we have to learn and so much we have to struggle with. I remember the verse always going through my mind, "My word shall not return void." You know, remember that. And I think that I didn't really think a lot about how the Indians were hearing my question, "Do you know the Christ?" I thought more about that magical, phenomenal thing that God had promised, that my word will not return void. And I think what I wasn't sure about was my communication that I shared heard by them as I had hoped it would be interpreted, or heard by them from their standing in a Hindu world where sin is not the evil that pervades the earth, but it's something too bad. And where the Christ is one of the prophets of all the gods, you see? And I was not yet mature enough in my Indian journey to take cognizance of that. And I think that's important for us, you know, to kind of deal with. And I think I was impatient too, you know, how long would it take for me to get through to a Hindu friend or a Hindu person who had 5,000 years of religious philosophy behind them and who lived in the conviction that karma had helped them to be birthed in the caste that they were born into, and that there would not be relief from that position except through Dharma, D-H-R-A-M-A, which was working toward that ultimate merging with the Brahma, which was perfection. And that the only sure release would be reincarnation. How long would it be until I could walk in the moccasins of the Indian people? They didn't wear shoes. That's not a very good image. That's not a very good image. But how long would it take before I could share that marvelous gift that they were in bondage? That they were in bondage to their religious philosophies. So I became extremely impatient. And it was at that time a kind of darkness that I perceived among the Indian people. I want to tell you a little story about India. I didn't talk a lot about India yesterday, but I think I have a story that's rather indicative of some of the things that happen to people that cross cultural boundaries and really have a zeal for sharing the good news with a foreign people. My husband and I and our children lived in a village town of about 50,000 people called Vaniambadi. It was half Muslim and half Hindu. And my husband, who was a real go-getter, he searched in that area for a place that had never heard the name of Jesus, where he could begin to do some visiting and some sharing. And as fate would have it, it was 17 miles away on very dirt and cobbled roads. But Jim decided to go into that village. It was a village called Marimankupam, and it was a high caste village. It was not a low caste village. And that was also very unusual. Usually one went to the low caste people, at least that has been the practice of the church, because they seemed to need it a little bit more than the higher caste. And so he drove out there every night on a motorcycle, 17 miles. And the kind of darkness that they were experiencing in that village was illiteracy. Illiteracy in India is, I don't even know the percentage. But he decided that that would be a way of sharing a gift with the people there, at the same time sharing the gift of the stories of a caring Christ. And I used to go with him whenever I was able to. And it was a village that was set off from the main road about a mile. It was a huge, long road that led right into the village. And so he went there every night, and when we would go, they had built a little town hall with open sides. And as people do in India, no one's affairs are private. If you would go for literacy training, and these were all for adults, the whole village came out. Well, maybe not the whole village, but half of them came and stood around, you know, the townhouse, and listened and watched. And it was fascinating that the children of these adults came along with them because they were educated. And it was an interesting exercise to see the children showing their parents what the words were and helping them to read. And Jim's syllabus was sort of, you know, to begin the evening by the parables of Jesus. The Indian folks love stories, right, Jim? Love the storytelling. And every night he told another story of this caring Christ. And together with that, he would have some math and have literacy. He did this for almost 8 years. And when I would come with him, we would go into the homes afterwards when it was all finished and see how Saroja was doing, or one of the women there. No, Saroja, it couldn't have been Saroja because that's a Christian name. They were all Hindu people. And we made very good friends with that village. Well, after a number of years, there were two men, one called Munasami and Krishnasami. And one was a milkman who rode his bicycle around the village and sold milk. And Vaniambadi was 17 miles away, but they came out to our house several times and sat with Jim into the wee hours of the morning, chewing the rag about theology, really talking about this phenomenon of grace. And they just couldn't understand it. They said there has got to be a hooker in the crowd, you know? That is not the way we live our lives. There has got to be good that you need to do to reach your perfected state. They would go round and round about this thing. And there came a time close to when we were to leave that these men were contemplating baptism, actually contemplating baptism. It was just a wonderful sense of hard work, of having been accomplished. You never know what's going to happen in God's time. And right before we were to leave, Munasami came, and they always had to come by bus, you know, which took them a couple hours always. Munasami came, and he told us that he wanted the whole family to come for a farewell to the village. And shortly after, and he said, the whole family must come. You don't leave the five-year-old behind, nobody. It's going to be at night, but we'll take care of you. And What had happened in the meantime was that Munasami's wife had given birth to a baby girl that had no pupils in the eyes. And so she was born blind. And when Munasami came, and this was before he had invited us to the farewell, he said to Jim, "Well, this is a curse of the gods that I have even inquired about the Christ." And at the farewell, and I have to tell you a little bit about that, we all of us drove out there, the whole family and the eight kids, we were piling a Studebaker, I think. Wasn't that, I don't think we had a Jeep at that time, Ted, right? And it was monsoon. The monsoons had just finished, and so all the potholes were just full of water. And as we turned the curve into the village, the whole car just went right down into the mud hole, and we still had about a mile to go into the village. It was pitch black out there. It was just pitch black. And so we said, "Well, kids, let's get out and let's try to push the car." And my daughter, in the meantime, lost her sandal in the mud, and we had a little flashlight, you know, to try to see. Well, we simply could not get that car out of the mud. And so finally, we said to the children to stay behind, and my husband went into the village and told the men what had happened. And so I can't remember the exact sequence, but I think we started to walk into the village, because after all, why would we stay back there with the car? The men would bring the car in. As we neared the village, the men who were going to pull out the car ran toward us, and they said, "No, no, no, no." They said, "Stop." They said, "You must wait for the car." And so they all went, there must have been 10 men went back there and lifted the car out of the mud, literally. And my husband drove it up to the center of the lane, and we all piled back into the car. Well, what had happened was that they had a band that they wanted to lead us into the village. And so if we would be in the village, they couldn't do that. So they insisted that we get back in the car. And I remember one of the children almost fainting with the heat, because all the people were around the car. They're just an incredibly loving people, and had appreciated Jim's work there. So we got into the village, and the whole village was out. There must have been 500 to 1,000 people there to say goodbye. They had a stage and garlands and the whole works. And to make a long story short, Munasami's gift to Jim was a copy of the Hindu scriptures. And when we left that village, it was probably a time of deep darkness for us. That why, O God, at a time when the heart was inquiring after you, did you allow to be sent such a burden to this family? Well, that was a personal darkness that we were going through. But I believe that in my years in India, I think our perceptions that grew about our country, our home country, and it's very interesting to perceive your own country from a foreign land. And I'm sure that many of you have had that chance to say, where do I really come from and what is my homeland about? And that I perceived a kind of darkness in the U.S. that India did not have. That I could sense in them a love and a dependence on community. That when they passed you or asked you to come over, that they looked you in the eye without a lot of clutter in their heads about their next agenda and about what TV program they were going to watch that night. They had time for people, which was a light for us coming out of the U.S., which was a network of craziness and busyness. They were closer to nature. And they had quiet plows, hand plows, Everything was close to the earth. And those were some of the things that became very precious to us as people who lived there over a period of 17 years. And you know, I think what struck me about that so much was that we from the U.S. usually think of ourselves as people of light. You know, not only because of our faith, but because also of our ability to accumulate wealth and power. We have incredible resources, you know, about an unlimited faith in our ability to solve problems by technology. We feel that that is a light to the world, and that we have an unlimited ability to grow and to conquer the natural world. Now, we might say that that is light to the world, but I have been reading a book in preparation for my topic today. It's just an incredibly difficult book. It was so hard to get through. It's called Light in Our Darkness, and that's where I took my topic, by Douglas John Hall. And he contends that these very blessings that we feel are gifts to the world are indeed our darkness here in the U.S. I wonder if there are just any questions before I move on to that segment. Are there any questions about India, maybe, that I don't want to go into long discourses about the food they eat or anything like that, but if there's anything I could clarify for you or that you'd like to know? Yes?
I walked in late, and I didn't take in the session yesterday, so you probably covered this, but when you're over there, Indians, they speak English, or they have their own language?
Almost. Happened to be in a Tamil-speaking area. There are about 400 languages in India. You can go within 20 miles and you will always find a new language. But since the British were there for over a century, almost all people know some English. It's very interesting, unless you get into the very, very, you know, the boonies of India. But it's something that is not true of a country like Japan, you know, or some of the more industrialized nations. Almost Indians could communicate very well. But we did learn the Tamil language. You know, you never feel a part of the culture, really, unless you learn the language. That's where you learn who they are as a people. Anything else?
Sammy?
Yes. Yeah.
Were you prepared by the church before you went, or given counsel along, when you talk about years and years and years of work with not a single soul to show? I mean, if the church is counting souls, and you know, I have a lot of problems with that notion, but
that's right.
But how did they describe what would be success to you in terms of your assignment there?
Yes.
Did you feel as though you had success?
Well, yes, I think I really told you the story of one of our contacts, which was this village. That was the last 6 years of our years in India, the last 5 years. Before that, there had been, and I may be telling this story later on, but we had a cholera epidemic in one of the villages, and the hospital team from our Ambur hospital came in and set up a clinic in a church. And the entire village that had contracted cholera, there were about more than 70 people that were treated at this church. All 70 of them came to be members of our church there in Govindapuram. So there were successes, if you want to call that success, but in different contexts. But this particular area was, again, see, where we were, there were several Christian churches already established, so people were quite aware of Christianity. But Mari Mankuppam was untouched. And as a sequel to that, I really have to say that today, a pastor went there later on as a follow-up to Jim's work, and is having a wonderful success there. And you see, the seeds always have to be somehow laid, and the groundwork laid. And somehow it has to be assimilated, and people need to begin to understand exactly what this is that you're offering them. And it takes years. And you see, and the other part of that is that the whole Hindu religion is so integrated with everything the people do. They do not get married without a very auspicious day, and do not buy land. And to imagine that these people would divorce themselves from that security is almost too much to imagine. We would not do that.
President
Reagan does.
Pardon?
Reagan does. Reagan does, yeah. That's true. But you see, so, and of course, the Muslim work was just another whole different story. That was even much more difficult in terms of that success that people, that you feel always feeds your work. You know, it's worthwhile. You want to be known as being worthwhile. But it was an experience that again, we felt we had shared something without, it was done in a way that said the kingdom of God is around, the kingdom of God is at hand, rather than that hell is around the corner. You know, very often our Christian message comes across as, you know, believe or be damned. And I do look at our work and Jim's particular relationship with these people as a very caring one, and as very conscious of where these people were as Hindu people and as just a wonderful group of people. But, you know, I can't say that there were no successes in our time. There were.
But did the church expect you to count success by conversions?
Yes, they did. Yes, they did, which was a real, it was sort of a millstone around our necks. And we paid no attention to that because, you know, you say you don't pay attention to it, and they would never have pulled anybody out just because you don't have success in those terms. But I'm not sure we were totally prepared, you know, for going into that kind of a situation. They told us of missionaries who had, you know, hung in there, and we had Sanskrit, and I'm not sure that we were totally prepared. Yes?
What would you say was the that in Christianity which was most appealing to them? Was it the wrestling with grace, or were there some entry points that you discovered after a while?
That was appealing to them?
Yeah, I mean, to speak to Hindus, it seems to me that...
Yes.
What appealed to them in Christianity?
Well, I think their theology of the Dharma, which meant that they really needed to work their way into a reincarnation of a higher caste or a higher person that would be born again, is one of the greatest bondages that the Hindu person would see in contrast to the grace, I think, that Christianity would offer. And their songs are all very freed-up songs and very different than the African song, but songs of praise and celebration. And we have many, you know, it's 2% Christian in India. That's it. But we had many third-generation Christians that were in, you know, in our communities there. So, okay, I want to share something about this book that I have read with you, and I've just been I'm a little bit fearful of doing so. I have to really admit that, because there's some kind of difficult concepts And I really want you to call me on it when you don't understand what I'm saying, because I've been steeped in it for so long now that I have a feeling I understand some of those without clarifying it real clearly. One of his first premises is that man and woman were made in the image of God as co-creators in the world. has replaced God as Lord of the universe. That we, through the technological age, have pushed God back into the transcendent and have identified ourselves not as one with nature, but above the natural world. I'm going to be having some quotes for you, and I hope it doesn't get too long and that our time doesn't run out. But they're kind of important. But that man and woman, instead of being a part of nature and the co-creators that we were to be intended with God to love the world and the universe and all creation, have through technology and in the name of progress become masters of the universe and have pushed God out. We needed him out, or her out, so that we could continue without that which we were called to love the land and to love creation. They edged God out, he says, not in the name of anything so crass as agnosticism, but precisely in the name of God, quite another being, in fact, despite the innocent attempt of the English to transliterate the Hebrew word for God. The Theos, or God of the Greek New Testament, who manifests himself in a suffering humanity, became a refined Zeus, like a Roman god. Now remember, this analysis, there's always an exaggeration, and we could always find to the generalization you have exceptions. You could always find exceptions. But generally speaking, I found it to be very, very true. It says, it is true that in the intention of God, humanity is granted a certain authority in the creation, and so over his or her own destiny, according to the biblical concept of humanity's creaturely nature. But humanity's dominion is a matter of permanent tension from the outset in Hebraic thought. He says this, dominion means something quite different as soon as this sense of nature's need is lost. The husbandry of animals, plants, and land gives place to the development mentality. Between humanity and the earth, to which humanity also belongs, there comes to be an intensity of alienation, quite different from what has been known even in ages past. Humanity have always experienced nature's strangeness, kind of. The scriptures attribute that to humanity's own act and state of estrangement themselves. That's what he identifies as sin. But never before in history has humanity been able to reduce nature to forces so totally devoid of spirit, so completely material, so incapable of need, that humanity recognized in it no real affinity with himself or herself. And I think that, you know, I think that there is a truth in that. The quest for mastery has built into it an insoluble problem of authority. The dominion which we find in Scripture does not speak of that kind of authority or mastering. It speaks of stewardship. Mastery defies distribution. It moves toward mastery of one over others, of each over a neighbor. It lends itself to schemes of the powerful to lord it over the powerless. the rich to acquire even more riches at the expense of the poor. It assumes that those who best achieve domination have best achieved their human destiny. It is fundamentally individualistic in the worst sense of that word. There is an inherent connection between man and woman's recognition of belonging to others and the recognition that he or she and his or her species belong to a larger than human community. I just felt those were some excerpts from his view on mastery that were just very vital. Another contention he makes is that by our own progress, or in the name of progress, we have brought about what Hall calls a contradiction in place of a dialogue between these two entities, expectancy and experience. And let me try to explain that. He says that instead of when these two entities get out of sync, expectancy, which we think of as hope, and all human race has hope, expectancy, and that expectancy is what? Purposeful and meaningful life. Food and clothing, educating and food for the mind, the gifts of the earth. And when the experience, the history which we need to move through and which has been moving us through, denies that expectation, that the actual experience has showed us that our hope is misdirected. We are not getting purposeful life. We are not getting meaningful life. We are getting separation from nature. We are getting war and divisions among peoples. We are getting all the false worlds that are not answering the hope that we had to begin with. And he says that is understandable, Hall says. But there must be dialogue then. There must be dialogue among churches, among peoples, among governments, among agencies, when they see this thing getting out of sync, that the hope and the history is out of sync. And he says what happens then is that we need then to deal with a contradiction. That we have to deal then with a contradiction. Human life, he says, is a dialogue between expectation and experience. The function of expectation, of hope, is to deliver us from bondage of the past. That's what keeps El Salvador alive, and that is what keeps Nicaragua alive, and the Ethiopians who starve. That expectation which relieves them from the bondage of the past. When expectancy ceases, death occurs. When you have no hope, death occurs. That's personally, it's societally, it's worldwide, when hope dies. The function of experience, however, is to keep us tied to the life of the body and to history. And to that expectancy, to that hope. That is the function of experience. When experience ceases to inform existence, the consequence is total illusion. Human life is thus a perilous journey between death and illusion. It is always something of a miracle, he says, when experience actually offers what is longed for, when the hopes and fears of all the years are met in Bethlehem of all places. Nevertheless, in the state of conflict, at least the possibility of a correspondence between hope and history is entertained. Men and women give themselves over to the conflict. They struggle with that contradiction, not because they enjoy the struggle, but because they dare to believe that what they hope for might really come to pass. A state of contradiction has been reached at the point where that possibility is no longer believed in or sought after. The dialogue between expectation and experience has been virtually closed. The logical thing would be to admit its end. Then we should say our expectations are finished. But the essence of that contradictory state in which we find ourselves is that such an admission is precisely what we cannot say it. We cannot admit to having failed in this society, of having met the expectations of a meaningful life and purposeful life. And one more very small one. There is no more urgent political vocation today than to help Western man and woman come to terms with that contradiction in which he or she lives. Most of the involvements to which we are urged by political activism are superficial. Unless Western humanity, North American man and woman, can be made aware of this contradiction, no conceivable alterations in the economic or political structures of his or her society will be able to save the world from the consequences of his or her anxiety and self-loathing. And he calls the political people who are today leading the nation and running for office to look into that kind of dialogue. He says that we have two monologues going on, one about expectations and the other monologue about false experiences. How do we as a society deal with this contradiction? We are called the optimistic society. Instead of recognizing the dilemma, what do we say? We say, don't worry, the problem can be solved by technology. We can take care of anything. Don't worry. We have denied the fact that our hope has been denied, that we have not experienced that fullness of what we had hoped for. We negate it, and we blame our problems on other nations, which leads to the Cold War. It's not our fault. It's because other nations are bringing in all these other dynamics into our lives. The trade policies are bad. And we have tended to blame other nations for what is happening to us. And the third thing that we do is that we create other false worlds in order to fulfill those expectations. And what I mean by that is that we are told that if only we would have a better car, or if we would get a new rug, or a new house, or establish a good sound business. You know, and all these things have a partial truth, but they are false experiences for us to meet the expectations that we have as human beings that were made to be a part of nature. And we live in this incredible dilemma, always climbing the ladder, always searching for that new, the better, and the more. Instead of dialoguing about this contradiction which we see and seeing how can we pull it into a sphere that will give us that meaning and purpose for which we long so much. And the confronting question of this study, I should maybe stop questions. We could talk about this for 2 weeks. We really could. But I wanted to touch some of those highlights. By the way, I did not ever send in the name of this book to the bookshop. I wasn't sure at the time. I hadn't read it, and I didn't know. But you know what I could do? If anybody would like, I could put it in the resource library. I'm going to be here for 3 weeks. And I could put it in the library, and people could page through it. In fact, what I did to under it, you know, it's and I don't intend to say it's not understandable, but the concepts that he has are so foreign to our thinking that you have to kind of reread it to see how is he relating this to our Christian theology, you know. And but what I did was I took excerpts out of this whole book, and I have 42 pages of typewritten excerpts, and I would be happy to lend this to anybody if they would just be interested in reading it. I would be very happy to do that. I could maybe just put it in the resource library just so I get it back. That is my only, one and only copy. The two final things that he says, and this will be in conclusion, and I'm afraid we're not going to have a lot of time for discussion, but he is confronting the church. He says the confronting question of this study is, can Christianity provide for a new and creative meeting of these two elements whose dialogue is basic to human life and culture? In other words, where is the church on this question of experiences answering expectations? And he says, ask what would be necessary by way of the transformation of Christianity for such a thing to occur, that we as the church, who say we have the light, would be able to at least give a part of the answer out of the theological basis. I need to read this to you yet. The Christianity that has become manifest as the dominant religious institution of this continent is totally, perhaps inextricably, identified with positive outlook, whose character we traced in all what I have been talking about before. This Christianity is nothing more nor less than the official religion of the officially optimistic society. The very faith toward which one looks for redemptive possibilities has been established in such a way on this continent as to make it almost inaccessible to us as light in the real darkness in which we find ourselves today. And the last quote, there can be no doubt that what comes through today to the great majority, both of intellectuals and of the poor, is that what they hear from the churches is a positiveness that is phony and even ridiculous. A bright and happy message that has all the depth of a singing commercial. Don't worry, Jesus will take care of it. Don't worry. There's a partial truth in that. Many men and women are open to genuine declarations of hope, but only if those declarations emanate from persons who give evidence in their words and deeds of knowing the extent of the degradation to which it is possible for human life to sink. It is no sign of the relevance of the gospel that our churches are full of the same people who raise no questions about the critical, moral, and political issues of our time, and who trust authority implicitly. We will never risk going against authority. That's why our government is so successful. The test of authenticity is rather the response of those whose vigilance for humanity has made them anxious, those real citizens whose sense of truth and justice has driven them to question every principle, every institution of our society. For Paul, the glory of Jesus consists in the fact that he makes his disciples on earth willing and capable to bear the cross after him. That is Luther and Paul's answer, that there is no theology of the resurrection until we deal with the theology of the cross. Calvary with a cross deeply embedded in the earth. that Christ who is in our darkness with us, who perceives our darkness more than any society or psychologist or philanthropist could ever do, and that theology of the cross, that Christ with us, must come before the resurrection. The theology of the resurrection is at this point a chapter in the theology of the cross, not even of glory. It must not be overlooked that the whole intention of this theology is to bear witness to the incarnation. The theology of the cross is first of all a way of speaking about the character of God's entry into the sphere of human history, not up there in heaven where we have made God to stay because of our mastery of the earth. It is not merely a statement about the death of Jesus, but about his life and the meaning of his life for our lives. The basic point of this theology is not to reveal that our condition is one of darkness and death. It is to reveal to us that the one who meets us in our darkness, it is to reveal to us the one who meets us in our darkness and death. It is a theology of the cross, not because it wants to put forward this ghastly spectacle as a final statement about life in this world, but because it insists that God, who wills to meet us, love us, redeem us, meets, loves, and redeems us precisely where we are, in the valley of the shadow of death. The theology of the cross declares God is with you, Emmanuel. He is alongside you in your suffering. He is in the darkest place of your dark night. You do not have to look for him in the sky, beyond the stars, in infinite light, in glory unimaginable. He is incarnate. That means he has been crucified. For to become flesh, to become one of us, means not only to be born, but also to die and to fail. There may be, after all, a kind of expectancy that is not extinguished, but actually springs into life through the experience of negation. In conclusion, then, the prayer, "Lighten Our Darkness," says, not only give us light, but give us the comprehension of our real darkness, that we may see the light. There is no light without first perceiving the darkness. And how many of us haven't experienced that in grief, in times of grief, and in times of incredible depression and suffering, that state of our personal darkness has been a receptacle, literally, for the light of Christ to struggle with us in our darkness, not to dispel it, not to negate it, not to optimistically say, oh, just keep busy and forget about it, but in the darkness. I did a devotion once after my husband died on the fight in faith, and I'd like to read you that sometime. I brought it along with me just in case it would be appropriate, but the fight in faith of how I was able to fight with God, and that I did not feel that was blasphemous, but I pounded on the steering wheel and I shouted at God, where are your promises of 70 years for those who love you, and of your sins will be white as snow, and where are all those promises? And I think that my healing came in that struggle of darkness, and really helped me to see my God not as a distant encounter, a transcendent being, but a friend who is able and willing to be fought with, to be encountered, to be confronted with the promises that he or she has given. And that was a real breakthrough for me in my own struggle with recapturing the wholeness that I knew was mine as a single person. And it was a way of knowing that God was with me in that very darkness. So the very thing that saves us is what we fear, going into and dealing with our darkness. This concludes my talk for today, and I know that the tape will be shut off, but I would be very happy to stay for 5 or 10 minutes if you'd like to talk about this. I know that there is so much more that I could have said about it. Why is it that the church has not been the answer? How do we deal with sin? What have we done with sin, for instance? There's an interesting little sideline, said. We have domesticated sin. We have made it into the sins of adultery, or, you know, which are also sins, but that evil which pervades the world, the demonic, we have not captured that and offered that to people. Anyway, are there any things that you would like to say? Yes.
What was your reaction? I this is your gift that you received, the book of the Hindu religion. What was your reaction when you received that gift after all these years? Was it
Well, you know what happened when we went away from the stage. Is that what you mean, when we received the gift of the book?
How was your reaction?
Oh, it was just devastating.
It was
a real personal darkness for us, you know. And what they did then was, when I say they, it almost sounds like talking about the enemy. They were our very close friends. But the villagers then, and something that we hadn't understood about some of their practices, we were driving out of the village in the car, and they took coconuts and they cracked them on the car. They threw them onto the car and cracked them. And that, we perceived, was only given to the gods. That was only something that was done in honor and respect of the gods. And my husband, Jim, literally jumped out of the car. He was a very fast reactor. He jumped out of the car, and he literally took one of them and shook them, and he said, "Don't dare to do that. There is only one God. There is only one God in Jesus Christ." And he was frantic, you know. And then later on, when we got back home, someone was also a Christian, but really, you know, knew the Hinduism, said, "Well, that was not only done for the God, but someone, a teacher, whom they respected very highly." So then we felt just terrible, you know, how we had reacted to this. But it was a terrible way to leave India. You know, it was, and they loved us. They literally would have done anything for us. And they would sit by the village well and talk for hours with us, with my husband especially, who was out there daily. But you see, that was the only way that they could say to us, you know, this is where we're still at. This is our security. Mm-hmm. And so it was just an incredible way to leave India. But I think that in our hearts we were also prepared. It would have been an incredible gift, you know, a sort of a bolstering of our own work, you know, to say, well, something turned out right. But there were many other occasions in our times there when that message of Christ's healing power meant, you know, and really did cause people to say, "I do believe," you know. And as I was mentioning, this village where they were cholera just swept, and you know, the hospital teams came in there, and this is unheard of, that a person will handle cholera patients, you know, that they will, because it's a, you know, what cholera is a double bucket disease. You know, they vomit as well as diarrhea at the same time, which eventually leads to dehydration. So that church, little church room, had to be cleaned continually, just being cleaned. And people stood around the clock caring for these folks. And they came en masse, and they said, "Never have we experienced love like this." And so, you know, it was not the preaching that brought them over, you know, that that was that was one method of speaking to village people, was that you would get on a bandbox, you know, a little box, and you'd sing a Christian lyric, and there was very little follow-up, but it was one way, you know, of reaching the people. And missionaries would go from village to village and not really spend a lot of time. And that came a little bit later, as the knowledge of what happens to people when you suddenly come in with this Western philosophy, Western theology to them, and lay it on them like that. You know, we expect the Spirit, but I think Spirit needs a little help once in a while, too. So that was a very special time, though. Yes?
Did you find that Christian converts actually had a dual religion? They maintained their Hindu connection?
Well, that's a real interesting question. I think this happened... And I don't want to take pot shots at the Catholic Church, but it happened very much in the Catholic Church because of the icons also that the Catholic Church has in their processions of the Catholic Church. One always found the icon there, you know, of Mary or of any one of their saints. But you see that the Hindus also feel that they don't actually pray to that stone idol. That is a representation. Yesterday I had pictures up of about 15 of the gods, Ganesh and Krishna and some of the others. But that is a representation of one of the characteristics of the god. And so they feel, and I think the Catholic Church also, I think they really felt that to bring them on board, first of all, don't kind of knock down all of their crutches, so to speak, but bring them on board, and that will affect them and infect them. But I will say I'm not sure about that. I do remember some very new converts. We were in a gold mining area in Kolar Goldfields for about 5 years, and Jim had set up. There were lines in the gold fields, and it was very easy to set up evangelistic meetings there that were not run by him, but were run by the foremen of the mines who were Christians of our church. And there always was a little courtyard in the back of the house with a grapevine going up, which shielded the whole courtyard from the sun. And that's where they had these little meetings. And I remember several converts from those particular kinds of meetings, and they would they came just with tears running up down their faces, and with an offering of a chicken, and you know, they were just as poor could be, and I think that freedom, that's what the Indian Christian, we have. Jim is sitting over here from Ceylon, whom we worked with. Jim Fergan spent many years in India. I'm sure he could tell you many stories of the villages there, but